Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. You might have heard this radio show called Mountain Stage. The show produced by folks right here in Appalachia has been featuring artists from across the world for more than 30 years.
As time went by, we saw, Larry is, bringing all the different types of music in here. And that took a while to, for me to understand.
Mountain Stage has helped to create a lot of memories over the years. On today's show, we're going to hear some of those personal moments around the show. We'll also remember the time that R.E.M. played on the show 25 years ago.
After the Out of Time CD, R.E.M. had decided not to tour. So all they did was Saturday Night Live, MTV's Unplugged, and Mountain Stage.
A lot can happen in 33 years. We'll take a look back at the moments that matter on Mountain Stage and beyond this week on Inside Appalachia. Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The first time I heard this song was at the Chuck Mathena Center in Princeton, West Virginia in 2014. I'll admit, it was my first Mountain Stage show. Before that evening, I'd never heard of Hooray for the Riff Raff, the band that's singing this song. I went to the show because Willie Watson and Roseanne Cash were also playing. I enjoyed them all, but it was great to find a new artist, and the fact that I found them in my home county, well, that's pretty cool. Mountain Stage is more than a radio show or podcast. It's more than live performances. It's a part of American history. While Mountain Stage has pulled a mix of up-and-comers and world-renowned talent, they were able to feature one of the world's biggest bands in April of 1991 when R.E.M. played on the show. The Mountain Stage crew is celebrating that occasion by collecting memories. You might be able to help, but we'll get to that later in the show. Now we're going to find out about how it all got started. Okay, quick history lesson. Mountain Stage is one of the longest-running live music performance shows on public radio. It began in 1983 and has featured nearly 2,000 acts from more than 50 countries and nearly every conceivable genre for a catalog of 871 shows and counting. Mountain Stage is currently heard on over 170 public radio stations across the country and is regularly in the top 30 music podcasts on iTunes. So how did it all start? Well, conveniently enough, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Dave Mistich produced a documentary in 2013 to celebrate Mountain Stage's 30th anniversary. In it, Dave shares the roots of the show and details how things have evolved over the years. You'll hear dozens of interviews, including ones from West Virginia musicians Tim O'Brien and Kathy Matea, Mountain Stage band members, and the show's original founders. Let's have a listen to Mountain Stage at 30, a radio retrospective.
In 1972, Francis Fisher moved to Elkins, West Virginia with his family, fresh off a 9-year stint in New York City working for NBC Radio.
I was a network engineer, and there weren't any networks in West Virginia at that time. And I just didn't think I would ever work in broadcasting again. But came a day when we got hungry, and the guy from the local radio station, WDNE, asked what I actually did in New York, and I told him.
Texas-born singer-songwriter Larry Gross also found himself in central West Virginia around the same time.
Francis was one of the people I met when I first came to West Virginia in 1972. At that time, he wasn't working for public broadcasting. He was the head engineer of WDNE, commercial radio in Elkins. And he lived, he was kind of a back-to-the-lander there, had a place outside of town. And I went down there because I was working as an artist in residence, National Endowment Grant, in three counties, and one of them was Randolph County. The other was for Barber and Tucker, and I lived in Barber County. And so I met Francis there because I would go on the air there to talk about my program or to actually sing with the Currents Brothers, who were a bluegrass band from down in Randolph County.
No, I won't have to throw my money away into Radio producer and music promoter Andy Ridenour was priming his own career at then Concord College in Athens, West Virginia, before moving on to commercial radio.
I became involved in different aspects of the business and of radio, plus promoting and putting on concerts.
Thanks to a hit from Gross in 1976, he and Ridenour finally crossed paths.
I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth.
And I had met Larry. He had had a top 10 novelty hit when I was working in commercial radio in Beckley and met him in the studios there. And had an opportunity to see him on occasion. He was really good friends with Francis.
Jug Food Jackie was an oddball song to become a hit, although I knew it was popular because when I began to sing it in concert, immediately had response from a lot of kinds of people. So I always used it in the set. And I always liked to use humor and those kind of songs within my set when I was out performing because I knew I couldn't play the guitar great and I knew I couldn't get by just singing, you know, regular songs. So I had to throw some things in there for entertainment purposes. And one thing I could do is write some satires that made people laugh. So I always did that. And that one was the one that really hit big.
Gross began touring the country in support of Junk Food Junkie, and Ridenour joined West Virginia Public Broadcasting in 1977. Fisher also went to work for the organization in January 1978, relocating to southern West Virginia to handle television engineering. Ultimately, Fisher gravitated back toward radio.
After a couple of years in Beckley, it was decided to move the radio operation from Beckley to Charleston. And they asked me to do that, along with looking over the construction of a microwave system that would tie all of the radio transmitters together. That was my job to do the best I could with that.
Ridenour also began producing live broadcasts of local jazz pianist Bob Thompson for West Virginia Public Radio.
At the time, I was playing at the Holiday Inn, the Elk River Holiday Inn, with a trio. On the weekends, and Andy Ridenour used to come down and listen. Somewhere along the line, he got an idea, well, maybe we should do a live broadcast from here. So he came down, and we did a couple of Friday night live broadcasts from that location. Andy says that somewhere out of that grew the idea to do live music.
With the infrastructure and plenty of know-how in place, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's general manager at the time, Rich Eisworth, called upon the staff for new ideas to explore as part of the statewide radio network expansion. Then news host Andy Ridenour chimed in.
First idea that popped into my head was doing a musical variety show. And Rich said, well, you know, put something down on paper and see what you can do. And at that point, I went to Francis Fisher, who was the engineer for West Virginia Public Television and radio at that time. And asked him, did we have the capability of putting together a radio show that would be 2 hours and, you know, multiple acts on it and multiple facets, including some comedy and bits and skits and that kind of thing. And he said, not yet, but, you know, we can make it happen.
I said, number one, we can do it. Number two, I want to work on the project. But then there was a number three. I said, you got to get Larry Gross to host the thing.
At that time, it was going to be, they were trying to find money to do a once-a-month show in West Virginia because they knew that this system was going to broaden. They were going to be more towers. There were more things planned. So they knew as they had more, it would more of the state would hear it, more towers, more broadcasters.
Even during Mountain Stage's earliest moments of development, Gross had a broad vision for the program.
I felt like that I wanted to do something that was bigger than a West Virginia show. So I said to them, and it was a real thought, but it was obviously also kind of pie in the sky dream. I said, let's say that we're going to do a national show based in West Virginia, and it'll start out West Virginia, obviously, but let's aim at being a national show.
Finally, the pieces were in place for a one-off live show to be broadcast around the state.
We put some stuff down on paper, and it took us a while to raised the money to do a pilot show, which we did in 1981.
Live from the Cultural Center in Charleston, West Virginia, it's Mountain Stage with Larry Gross, co-host the Earl of Elkview. The Little West Virginia Symphony is under the direction of Vince Lewis. Special guests for our premiere show are Bob Wolpert, the Bob Thompson Jazz Trio, and the Pickers.
Over hills, beautiful hills, how I love the West Virginia hills. If o'er land or sea I roam, still I think of happy home and my friends among the West Virginia.
And we liked what we had come up with there. We had a in a house band and had guests on the show for the pilot that included Bob Thompson.
The show at that time had a little bit different flavor. And it was all people from the area, so we all knew each other. And so there was that kind of camaraderie, you know, because we were all friends. And there was it was music, but there were also storytelling and a lot of different things.
Despite the fact that everyone involved viewed the March 1981 pilot as a success, a lack of initial funding for continued tapings stalled regular production.
That was 1981. They didn't come up with enough money to actually planned for a season until 1983, 2 years later. Fast forward 2 years, and they said, well, we have some money now. We can do a show a month from December of 83 to December of 84.
And that's how it came to be. December of 1983 was our first regularly scheduled program.
Live from the Cultural Center Radio Theater in Charleston, the West Virginia Department of Culture and History and West Virginia Public Radio present Mountain State.
Come up early, don't be
soon. Guests on the show included Denny Bonet and Julie Adams, billed together as the fabulous Twister Sisters. After their first appearance, the Twister Sisters stayed on as regulars for Mountain Stage and eventually became part of the house band. Here's Julie Adams.
The first show just had a bass player and a pianist as the house band and Larry, and there was a co-host, George Doherty.
You know, I got my start on WRLX radio up at Elkview. That's relax radio, ladies and gentlemen. Did the news ever make you jumpy? You know, did you read the paper and listen to the news? Just sort of get that never happens on relax radio, I'll tell you. We're only 150 watts up there, but it's clear channel, and our motto is, if it sounds good, shoot her out there just as far as it'll go.
A colorful character known to audiences as the Earl of Elkview, Doherty acted not only as co-host, but also performed skits, monologues, and even played the saw.
It was very exciting to be a guest on the show because it was live radio. It was live in the state. So that was definitely an extra, well, you could say excitement, you could say terror.
Broadcasting live certainly made for some stressful moments for the performers and the crew, but with Fisher at the helm of mixing and engineering, the decision to produce the show live was an important one.
It's always been my belief that shows should be done live, and everybody has to be on their best behavior and just give the work their very best. And we were able to do that.
Probably a lot of us didn't quite get it then. You know, we didn't quite understand what Larry was going for in being as eclectic as he was and having, you know, a jazz band on right next to a bluegrass band.
That's John Kessler, a Charleston-area musician at the time, who first appeared on the show in February 1984 with local band Rhino Moon, and again in April of the same year with Stark Raven.
As time went by, we saw, oh, okay, Larry is really kind of, you know, bringing all the different types of music in here. And that took a while to, you know, for me to understand.
In its earliest stages, the show featured local and regional musicians from the Charleston area and elsewhere around West Virginia. At the time, says Gross, it was simply a matter of resources.
We put people on there, whoever we could get, obviously, anybody from around the state or anybody we thought would work. We did some comedy, we did this and that, and mostly music, but we put through a few other things in there.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, right now it's time to hear from one of our sponsors.
This portion of Mountain Stage is brought to you by Big Dip Snuff, the man's dip.
Friends, in today's wine and cheese world, it's important to stay loose and move fast. That's why Big Dip has introduced Light Dip, the dip that tastes great but has only about half the weight of our regular dip. So when you cram a wad of white light,
although the
dip,
show seemed to be more locally focused in the beginning, Ridenour says it wasn't long before Mountain Stage started taking off a bit and was soon attracting nationally recognized talent.
Opportunities came our way in the early days that we didn't expect, or didn't anticipate, I should say. When we were very new on the air, we had only produced just maybe a half a dozen or so shows. We got a letter from a listener in Wheeling, a woman who asked if we would like to have her son on the show. And it was from Mrs. O'Brien.
The Mrs. O'Brien that Ridenour refers to was the mother of Tim O'Brien of the iconic bluegrass group Hot Rise.
My mom said, well, I wrote to them and said, when are you going to get Hot Rise on there? And she said that they wrote back and said, well, of course we want them, and when can we do that?
Hot Rise's appearance on the show's sixth episode in May 1984 quickly opened doors for the still infant Mountain Stage, including their first show outside of West Virginia in June 1985.
From Charleston, South Carolina, welcome to Mountain Stage, live from the Piccolo Spoleto Festival with your host, Larry Gross.
It was in Spoleto where the show got its first true taste of the national spotlight.
NPR agreed to take us on. And one of the things that was dramatic that we did to kind of get their attention was we went and did a show down at Spoleto, and they agreed to let us broadcast live from there. And we used the NPR satellite dish, mobile dish. We were the first ones to use it.
The condition was that we'd have to bring Hot Rise with us, which they were more than happy to do. And so that led us to the realm of being a national program.
Although Mountain Stage was seeking national distribution and quickly reaching new heights, the State Department of Culture and History threatened to drop out as a co-sponsor and said it didn't want to be associated with the show if it dropped its West Virginia flavor.
I think the people over there wanted us to do only West Virginia acts on the show, but that was never our original intention. We did it for a while because that's all we could get, and we didn't have a choice. But we always wanted to bring in the best people we could get from the very beginning.
Gross says the Charleston community and the O'Brien family rallied in support of the show.
We felt helpless at first, but both newspapers here in Charleston, the Charleston Gazette and the Daily Mail, wrote editorials of Save Mountain Stage. And I know, I'm pretty sure, that Mr. and Mrs. O'Brien, Tim's parents, who were friends and supporters of Arch Moore, contacted him and his wife and Shelley and said, this is a good show.
Governor Moore ordered the agency to restore funding to the show, and Mountain Stage's fate was inevitably saved. And while the O'Brien family helped make that happen, Tim says the show was so good, even in the beginning, that Mountain Stage would have found another way.
I think Mountain Stage would have survived without my mother calling the governor, too, you know. I think it all will work. The good stuff tends to rise to the top and survive, I think.
Ultimately, Mountain Stage persevered and continued to feature world-renowned talent in music as well as other art forms, including the poetry of Allen Ginsberg in February 1986.
Prophecy. As I'm no longer young in life, and there seem to me not so many pleasures to look forward to, how fortunate to be free to write of cars and wars, truths of eras, throw away old useless ties and pants that don't fit.
In April 1986, the show positioned itself for its next big break, this time at the Public Radio Program Directors Conference in San Diego.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome once again to Mountain Stage Live Performance Radio from the Mountain State of West Virginia. But this week, we're coming to you from I don't know what state it is. I don't know what the mascot is, but it's California and the beautiful city of San Diego, or as we like to remember it, San Diego, home of the Love Boat.
Mountain Stage had a little help out in California from a West Virginia native who was becoming a fast friend and a rising star, Kathy Mattea. And they'd waltz the aisles of the Five and Dime.
In 85, I hadn't had a hit, and they had me on. And I remember thinking, gosh, these guys are doing this thing out of my hometown. What ambition. How great is this? And then they called and said, hey, we're going to get try to go national. So I flew to San Diego. Married up in Abilene, lost a child in Tennessee.
Oh, still that love survived. Around the same time, the Mountain Stage Band began to solidify its lineup. Originally including pianist Eric Kitchen and bass player Scott Green, the show soon began recruiting musicians from locally revered band Stark Raven, which, in addition to Bonet and Adams, also included drummer Ahmed Solomon.
It started with Denny and Julie. They were the first in the early days when they were putting the band together. They added the bass, John Kessler, and shortly after they added me.
So that's when I started scheming to be on the show.
Stark Raven guitarist Ron Soule.
Back then, they did a lot of comedy, and I knew that doing good comedy takes a lot of time to write. Larry was a great writer, but he didn't have a lot of time, so I started writing some comedy skits and submitted them, and Larry did, I think, just about everything I submitted. So I used to hang out at the rehearsal, just watching them put the skits together. And one day, Larry said, hey, I need a harmonica player on the next show. He said, hey, you play harmonica, don't you?
It was maybe a year or so later. They added Ron. And then, you know, we look around and we realize, oh, hey, look, it's Stark Raven.
Being in the Mountain Stage Band was a real education in the breadth of music and styles. And for us, you know, young musicians, being asked to perform with some national acts was definitely inspiring, and also made you really want to work hard and be really good.
The first core of that was we actually knew each other pretty well. And so that was, you know, that was actually really helpful because, you know, you when you know each other that well and you play a lot, you kind of have your own language and you kind of read each other's minds a little bit.
Denny Bonet says there was never a lack of creativity.
Once the show started getting more and more popular and we had to come up with more and more music, you know, we kind of kidded around and called it kind of the handy wipes of music, because you would write a song on Tuesday and get to perform it live on national radio by Sunday.
In 1986, Mountain Stage was picked up by NPR on a regular basis. But, as Gross says, getting distribution wasn't exactly easy.
Culturally, most of the rest of the country wants to fit us into yeehaw, get out your fiddle and your banjo, stomp the ground, let's drink some moonshine and play some old-time country music and some old-time mountain music. And there's nothing wrong with that because it's fun. A lot of that, we do some of that, but that's not all we do. And frankly, that's not all West Virginians like. West Virginians are a diverse people. You know, they're not all one type of person, but they like a lot of things.
Mountain Stage is a brand I'm very proud of now, and we worked very hard to develop that brand. But if in the earlier days, when the show was in its beginning moments of being a national program, I would have fired the person who came up with the name Mountain Stage for the show, because it was such a hard sell in many ways. A show from West Virginia with the name Mountain in it was not an easy sell in a lot of markets around the country. I couldn't fire that person because it was me.
Eventually, the show began to overcome that hurdle and many program directors started picking up the show, including Rusty Smith of WOUB in Athens, Ohio.
In the late 80s, we were putting on a couple of additional transmitters, and we were rearranging our program schedule. And Mountain Stage had been on the air for a few years, and we had noticed it, you know, across the river whenever we listened to West Virginia Public Radio. And it was a great show, you know, live performance radio. So when we rearranged our schedule in the late 80s, when we increased our broadcast area, we included that as part of a live performance Saturday evening lineup, one of the big parts of that lineup.
In 1987, Mountain Stage found a new home at the Capitol Plaza Theater in downtown Charleston and continued to reel in some of the biggest names in American roots music, including Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Tony Trischka, Guy Clark, John Hartford, and Townes Van Zandt.
If I needed you, would you come to me? Would you come to me and ease my pain? If you needed me, I would come.
Once we got national and once we got going where we had an audience of some substance, it became a little easier and a little more interesting to try to look for folks who were emerging artists. I remember getting Lyle Lovett's first album and saying, wow, this guy's really good. And so we got him on.
We've been listening to a bit of the history of Mountain Stage, which began over 30 years ago and is based right here in Appalachia. When we come back, we'll hear about the event that helped launch Mountain Stage even further into the national spotlight. And we wanted to let you know about an upcoming live event that West Virginia Public Broadcasting is helping put on in about a week. The Moth Main Stage is coming to Charleston Sunday, May 29th. The show's producers said they wanted to come to West Virginia because here in Appalachia, we have such strong storytelling roots. And we'll be there passing out Inside Appalachia stickers. I'll be there too, so come up to Charleston and meet us in person and see some live storytelling. There's information about the event on our website, wvpublic.org/themoth. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're hearing the history of a radio show called Mountain Stage. In this next part of the story, we'll hear how the show evolved through the 90s and how a West Virginia governor helped save the show. But we'll hop back in at one of the biggest moments in the show's history, when critical and commercial rock giants REM came to Charleston, West Virginia for a taping of Mountain Stage.
Mountain Stage gained a friend in REM guitarist Peter Buck when he came on the show in April 1990 with Kevin Kinney.
At the end of his set, and I know who he was, of course. We all know who Peter Buck was and REM was. He said to me, this is a great show. I really love this show. I'm going to see if my band wants to come play it. And I thought, yeah, right. A while later, Andy came to me and he said, we just got a call from the manager of REM. Would you like to have REM on the show? And I said, any time of day or night, on any day of the week. Of course we want to have REM on the show.
Given REM's stature at the time, Gross and Company made a few accommodations for the band.
And by that time, we had moved back to the Culture Center. But we knew two reasons we needed to go back to the Capitol Plaza. Number one, that's where Peter Buck heard it, and he liked it, so we're going to go back there. Number two, it holds about three times as much audience as the Culture Center. So we plan to go back and do it a little bit differently.
Then associate producer Linda McSparron says the Mountain Stage staff knew that REM's appearance would be a big deal, but says they had no way to fully grasp its impact on the show.
We sold the show out in 9 minutes. Tickets were being scalped for $500 in Columbus. We thought we were just being outrageously overpricing at $20 a ticket, but that's when the show, we realized, okay, we're going.
The Mountain Stage appearance was important for us to do because it was not, it was certainly off of the normal beaten path for a rock band.
REM's band advisor, Burtis Downs.
It was not New York or London or L.A. We went to all those places, but we also went to Charleston, West Virginia and did the Mountain Stage show in that spring of 91.
After the Out of Time CD, REM had decided not to tour. So all they did was Saturday Night Live, MTV's Unplugged, and Mountain Stage.
It's a high-quality show. It's on National Public Radio in lots and lots of markets. It's a little unconventional in a certain sense, but it's highly respected among musicians and people who listen to NPR. It has a real loyal following. We all are big supporters of WUGA here in Athens. And so it seemed like a kind of, if you're going to do the obvious stuff, it's kind of fun to throw in some things that aren't as obvious or that other people might not have thought of.
You know, I can't stress enough the importance of REM doing our show. Just like we were fortunate to have Mrs. O'Brien send us a letter in the early days that gave us Hot Rise on the show, that gave us our first national broadcast, live national broadcast on National Public Radio. REM put us on a map in a whole different way. Because of their appearance on the show, we were on the Today Show, we were in Rolling Stone, we were in all the music magazines.
That's when Andy had to quit calling agents, and it reversed. Everything just flip-flop, and the agents were calling him. And that's when it really changed and became a national radio show that people were, whoa, this is cool, you know. That I mean, it always was cool, but this was like, it gave us the recognition, the high profile that we needed.
1991 proved to be a watershed year for Mountain Stage, not only because of REM's appearance and the increased attention to the show, but also because Bob Thompson came on to the show full-time, replacing then-recently departed Eric Kitchen in the house band.
At that time, I was doing a lot more traveling with my band and doing things on the road. And so I thought, you know, this would be fun. I'd like to do this for a little while. So I thought maybe I would do it for a year or something like that, and then I would get back to what I was doing. But the longer I did it, the more I enjoyed it.
In addition to expanding the breadth of music represented on the show, Gross and Company carried on through the 90s by making Mountain Stage a haven for artists both young and old.
Quit school, Chief 17. Senator on TV calls her welfare queen. Used to be.
We've played the smallest, you know, nastiest, stickiest floored bar rooms with the smallest crowds, and we played festivals in, you know, Europe just in front of 70,000 people.
Bottle Rocket's frontman Brian Henneman says the show offers artists something rarely possible in the scheme of regular touring.
It's a great spot in that spectrum. It's cool. It's something different. It's something that reaches more people than normal. You know, how many people may hear a show that we're on Mountain Stage? You don't really know. That's the magic of radio. You know, it's like, it's going to be a lot more people than you'll fit into a little bar room in Birmingham, Alabama, or whatever.
One of the things about the show is that some of the way attitudes we have and the practices we have were formed because I was on many shows. When I had a hit song, as weird as it was, I was on every show of the day. I was on The Tonight Show, The Midnight Special. I was on The Merv Griffin Show. I was on The Rich Little Show. I was on every kind of a show like that that you could have.
And those experiences, says Gross, have left an indelible mark on how Mountain Stage has operated over the years.
What I learned was there are certain ways of treating people that I never wanted to do on Mountain Stage. And then there were other ways that I really wanted to try to emulate.
And artists who have performed on the show have certainly taken notice, like singer-songwriter Robert Earl Keane.
There's a different feeling when you deal with somebody, someone like Mountain Stage. You know, people are truly friendly and open and glad you're there. And you know, they don't care if you're playing some weird folk tune or you're banging on a cymbal and blowing a kazoo at the same time. It's all about, you know, the enjoyment and the entertainment and the passion behind it, not about the focus group or the numbers. It's always about, you know, bringing the personality to the airways.
Bluegrass legend Ricky Skaggs says the show's welcoming nature fits in with their home in Appalachia.
Mountain Stage feels like family. You know, when any of us come here, we all kind of feel like we're coming, you know, coming back, you know, and coming to people that we love, you know, and I think a big part of that is just that thing here in the mountains. I mean, it's community, it's family, it's friends, and that's the thing I love about Mountain Stage. It really does feel like home. You know, I can't stress how different that is when you go and play a lot of other places.
Mountain Stage had another huge moment in 1994 when one of the world's preeminent roots rock groups came to perform on the show.
The band, by the way, is my favorite band of all time. It's my favorite rock and roll group ever. And in many ways, The Last Waltz is, if you look at that movie, you see the birth of Mountain Stage. I mean, all the acts that are on there, from that well has come a lot of the stuff that's on Mountain Stage. Not everything, but a whole lot of things.
That was the only show that Francis ever missed. And he was out west. And at the last minute, the band was available. And they decided they would go ahead and commit and do the show. And I was tapped to do the radio mix.
And while Gross trusted McClanahan with mixing duties for the show, technical difficulties almost spoiled the plan.
When I came in that Sunday morning, the main console was dead. I mean, dead, no lights, just a complete failed state. And we huddled together and we decided that the show was going to go on.
That's the way Mountain Stage is. You cannot have it not work. It has to work. So somehow you make it work. And that's what we did that day.
The band returned to the show in 1996, but this time Fisher was there at the helm of engineering. Although the show had certainly faced funding issues in the past, in 1999, Mountain Stage found itself in a particularly difficult financial situation. As Ridenour began meeting with advisors of then-Governor Underwood, they asked him what the show needed to continue. After getting help with private funding, the show was left about $200,000 short of what it needed to continue. And then something remarkable happened.
I remember hearing back from one of our supporters who said, listen to the Governor Underwood's State of the State speech tonight. And I said, okay.
Mountain Stage is a huge billboard for West Virginia that helps to attract business and tourism. Currently, this radio program reaches more than 110 stations that serve major markets across the nation. I propose a general revenue line item for the Mountain Stage in the amount of $200,000.
Mountain Stage carried on into the 21st century by sticking to their tried-and-true formula of mixing world-renowned talent with emerging artists. While the highlights are seemingly infinite, Ridenour says a trip to Scotland to kick off the show's 28th season was one of the big ones.
We had Tim O'Brien over there, and we had Mavis Staples and Doogie McLean. But, you know, it was an opportunity to take the show international. and spread, you know, spread the good word about Mountain Stage internationally in that way. Our CDs had already sold well in Europe, but it was nice to be able to take the show there.
Also in recent years, guitarist Ryan Kennedy was added to the Mountain Stage band. By far the youngest member, Kennedy says he relishes the opportunity to play with such an accomplished group of musicians.
It's always really exciting for me. It's always really interesting for me to find out where I fit into it. Trying to see what I can bring. You know, everyone's kind of got their own modus operandi, I guess, and I had to develop my own kind of sense as to where I fit into the band. And they're giving me the freedom to do that, too.
Ryan Nauer stepped down as producer in the fall of 2011, and associate producer Linda McSparren's retirement soon followed. Ryan Nauer's duties were handed over to former intern and then assistant producer Adam Harris.
I had done it for 28 years, and I had done everything I could do with it. It was time for somebody new, some new blood to step in and do it, and we mentored Adam for 2 years to take over, and I was very comfortable walking away. If we didn't have someone like Adam who could have the talents that he has to bring to the table to take it over, you know, I don't know if I would have been as ready and willing to walk away from it.
It's a big deal. It wasn't lost on me. These guys built a legacy, and not many people get to inherit such a legitimate legacy.
With Harris leading day-to-day operations of the show, Mountain Stage has continued to travel more and more in recent years, making stops in Athens, Georgia, Bristol, Tennessee, Grand Marais, Minnesota, among others. Not only does taking the show on the road provide financial security, it also helps engage audiences and spreads the word about the show. Harris says one such trip to Fairbanks, Alaska in August 2012 showed him the power of what they do.
When we went to Fairbanks, it's one of the hottest audiences we've ever had. I mean, they love and appreciate their radio up there, and they love and appreciate Mountain Stage. In the theme, you know, I say, with your host, Larry Gross. And there's still some theme song before we actually cue the audience for applause. They started applauding immediately.
And by Bailey and Glasser, welcome to another Mountain Stage with your host, Larry Gross.
There's a song in my heart.
You hear that theme song every Saturday, come out of your radio speakers.
Lori Neufeld of KUAC in Fairbanks.
And it doesn't always dawn on you that Larry Gross is singing that theme song live to an audience. And so I think that that's part of what made the Fairbanks audience erupt in such hoots and hollers and applause.
While giving the nod to well-established acts and longtime friends during their 30th season, one has to look no further than some of the bright young talent that Mountain Stage featured this past year to realize the show is not only staying relevant, but also thriving. Americana chart topper Jason Isbell says Mountain Stage is a necessary stop to gain a wider audience.
Well, there are always people listening to these kind of shows that haven't ever heard of us before. That's the thing for me. When we're playing our own shows or, you know, something even that's webcast, that's planned, what we're getting is a large number of people who already know who I am and already know the songs and are watching it or listening to it for that reason. And a show like this is going to have a built-in audience that doesn't necessarily know what we're doing, you know. Plus, when you put that many different artists together, somebody might be listening to Stephen Kellogg, you know, they might be tuning in because he's playing, and then they hear us as a side note and wind up liking it. So it's good for me anytime I can preach to somebody besides the choir.
Another of the show's favorites in recent years has been the rock group Dawes, who performed on the show's 800th episode in September of 2013.
I feel like our music is
steeped in tradition, and there's no way around it, and that's something we're very proud of. We like leaning on our influences, but at the same time, any band's dream is to be reverent to the music that you grew up listening to, but at the same time, having your own thing and making new music and having it feel like new music when people hear it, just so that you can carve out your own space and be your own, have your own identity.
Kentucky native and singing cellist Ben Salee.
I think that overall Appalachia has been very inclusive with other cultures and their styles and their sounds, which is to say that when you get in a holler and the people that live in the holler, they exchange ideas because of the geographical boundaries. And then those ideas kind of incubate in that area and they grow from that area and they become part of the identity of that area. And I think, if anything, Mountain Stage is that. It's an exchange of ideas within a growing community.
The legacy of Mountain Stage is important because of the artists that we've had, but also on our reliance on finding the next big performer. Hopefully finding young talent and bringing it to a broader audience that needs to be exposed to it. And part of our legacy is that we've done that with some artists that were maybe lesser known when they were on our show, and they've grown up. And a lot of them don't forget that. A lot of them don't forget some of their first national media exposure.
We would have never predicted Mountain Stage would have been here for 30 years. But one of the reasons we are is because we're constantly looking at the future. We're not looking at the past.
And looking to the future, says Gross, means handing over some of the show's direction to others.
In the future, I'm going to step away. And we're going to have some guest hosts come on and do the show. We're going to try some new things because I won't be here forever. And if the show continues to go, there will be somebody else. And we got to figure out how that is. That's a tough transition because the live host is a lot of the personality of the show. And so is the artistic direction. But I'm already starting to hand off some of that, too. I'm telling some of the other folks, the younger folks, saying, hey, you give me some bands.
As for Fisher, well, he has few plans of stepping aside anytime too soon.
I'm going to keep right on doing it until I just finally go deaf and they say you can't come back anymore. I'm working in the library reading the law. I'm working with the papers and brushes and pens. I finish up a job and I'm starting again. I guess my woman goodbye.
I'll be leaving soon. Working at the square dance, playing fiddle too. Trying to summarize Mountain Stage in their 30 years of live performance radio seems impossible. But if anyone deserves that task, it's two of the show's biggest supporters and most frequent guests, Tim O'Brien and Kathy Matea.
I think they've really stood their ground with a vision for, you know, unlimited choices and anything goes, and if it's good, it works for us. You know, most people, nowadays they would sort of figure out a market research and figure out how they're going to fit in. Instead, they just did what they wanted to do and people noticed. It's valuable.
It's like maybe we speak the same language or something because we're of the same place. I have to say, though, I feel, I tell you, I feel really proud of what they've all done and how they represented West Virginia and Appalachian culture and what they mean to the rest of the world. I mean, just to get to stand up next to them and say, these are my people, and, you know, this is like, what I love about music and culture and life and connections, and I feel my chest swell a little bit, you know, whenever I think about it.
That was singer-songwriter Kathy Matea in the documentary called Mountain Stage at 30, A Radio Retrospective. It was produced in 2013 by Dave Mistich of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. The documentary was well-received by Burtis Downs, REM's advisor, who shared a nice memory on the band's website. We've posted a link to it on our website at wvpublic.org. While you're there, you can share your own memories of that REM performance back in the spring of 1999. This year is the 25th anniversary of that famous Mountain Stage show. And to commemorate the anniversary, West Virginia Public Broadcasting is collecting memories. After all, it's the stuff of legend. REM was one of the most popular bands in the world at the time. It drew a lot of attention to the show and this region. It was no doubt an evening to remember for folks who were there. I chatted with Mountain Stage executive producer Adam Harris about the anniversary and found that they've collected a lot of memories already.
Governor Gaston Cabrian was there, and he declared it REM Day in West Virginia.
Oh, nice.
So a lot of people remembered that. We heard from a few people who remembered standing in line around the Capitol Plaza Theater that day, and Robin Hitchcock, who, a well-known artist, not quite as well-known as REM, was on the show as well. And Robin Hitchcock, famously, and we know it's true because a lot of people included this in their story, he serenaded the guests as they're waiting in line. He even took a few requests. Somebody even said, oh, he took my request for a Beatles song, you know. So a lot of really great personal memories we've gotten in already.
So do you have one that's your favorite in particular? I have to ask you, you mentioned one upstairs just a minute ago about perhaps someone, I don't know if they might have had the flu or they were drinking too much.
He claims that it wasn't because he was drinking so much, but yeah, one gentleman who submitted a story, unfortunately, got sick multiple times during the show, and there were lines at the bathrooms, and, you know, he tells it in fairly good detail, so I have no reason not to believe him. But finally, after he started feeling better, he came back in and really enjoyed the rest of the show.
Yeah,
and
so
even a couple
really
people owned up to having brought in video recording devices.
Ah.
And so even though that's highly discouraged in today's concert world, and even back then it was highly discouraged, there might be some video that we haven't seen yet, which is a big deal. And one of the reasons we wanted to do this is because we know there's some certain memorabilia out there that we'd like to get our hands on. And so hopefully through these stories, we're going to be able to reach out and maybe learn more and see more than we ever had thought possible from this show from 1991.
And you're a native of West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And
Greenbrier County.
That's right. And you get to bring and help, you know, bring these acts to West Virginia. What does that mean to you personally to be able to introduce some new music, maybe even some classic music, and bring that to residents here in West Virginia?
There's a lot of examples of both of those things. In other words, sometimes a younger crowd will come to see an older artist that we've booked, and I really love to help them in their music history by exposing them to someone who came prior to an artist that they've heard of. Because everything is linear. Everything comes from somewhere, you know.
Hmm.
Then there's always the people who, my favorite is the folks who come to the show to see one artist and they walk away probably a lifelong fan of another artist that they had never heard of prior to. And that happens all the time on Mountain Stage. It's just a proven fact that no matter who you came to see, you're going to get turned on to something that you maybe hadn't heard of before, and chances are you're going to walk away a fan of something completely new to you. And you will probably listen to it for the rest of your life. As you know, with music, mm-hmm. once you make that connection with it, it sticks around with you for a long time. And the fact that we're all the time getting to shape people's musical memories is just so rewarding to me. I mean, that's definitely the most rewarding part.
Adam, thank you so much for
joining
Jessica.
Us. Thanks, Jessica. Thanks for highlighting the show.
I'm sure those aren't the only memories Mountain Stage has been a part of. If you have a memory of the show you'd like to share, you can by going to wvpublic.org. We're glad to bring you some of the insider stories of the show. You know, the theme song for the show says, "There's a song in my heart, just a simple little tune," as you probably know. And somehow the show really does always have a song that connects to my heart. And we're glad to feature some of the songs on the show at times. We're so glad to be a part of a few of your memories. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by musicians and artists from Mountain Stage, including Hooray for the Riff Raff, Vieux Farcature, Roseanne Cash, REM, Bob Thompson, and more. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our show was edited by Dave Mistich. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. Our newest member of the team is Caitlin Campbell. She'll be helping out through the summer. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.